Hello, my name is Pete Redden, and this is another edition of The Way I Taught It, next level aviation knowledge in microbursts. Today's episode sponsor is RT Turbines, repair and maintenance from an FAA certified repair station you can trust. With over 50 years of combined experience using the latest in engine repair and maintenance technology, servicing each engine to the highest standards and ensuring FAA certification, RT Turbines can do it all from routine inspection, repair service, testing, and in-house manufacturing. Their experienced team of technicians will provide you with the optimal solutions to keep your engines in top condition. RT Turbines is a family-owned business with a quality promise in the aviation industry since 1996. Their commitment to quality and customer satisfaction is the foundation of their success. RTTurbines.com, repair and maintenance you can trust. Before we get into the podcast, I want to take a moment to introduce Dr. Joe McMurray. He is a full-time participating board-certified oral and maxillofacial surgeon. He's owned a 1999 Beach Bonanza A36, a 2012 Carbon Cub, and a 2020 Super Decathlon, and now owns one of the world's premier aerobatic aircraft, a Game Composites Gamebird GB1. Dr. Joe took time out of his demanding schedule to speak with The Way I Taught It on transitions training, his history of flying, and the lessons he's learned over time. It was my pleasure to interview Dr. Joe McMurray for The Way I Taught It. I hope you enjoy the insights that he shares about his aviation career and lessons learned in other career fields that he's brought to the aviation career field.
Dr. Joe, how are you?
Hey, Pete, I'm doing well. You hear me okay?
I hear you good. I like that airplane behind you.
She's a joy to fly. Absolute joy to fly. It is. I spent several days last week, 3 days at a camp I organized with Sergey. And I don't know if you know who he is, but he was the former Russian Unlimited and world champion, was also the head coach for the Russian world team, as well as a former coach for the U.S. Unlimited team back in the 80s and 90s and early part of 2000. Now he's settled into a role of coaching. I came across him, his number, through a friend of mine back east. Fabulous. You know,
it's a little bit of experience.
Oh, yeah. And coaching, you know, you have to vary from person to person, obviously, as you're quite aware, as well as how each coach is able to kind of extract that best part out of you, as well as see what your weaknesses are and able to dial it. Like, I know what you're doing when you're up there. And then the next thing he does is he tells you to do certain things. And it looks absolutely fabulous. I mean, Shane was on the ground watching. He saw what I did and he was judging, you know, just sort of an aside. And he says it was just like he was, like Coach Sergey was the remote control, and he would just push a couple of buttons and I would just dial things in. And he said, it was like night and day. As soon as he told you what you did or was doing wrong and you fixed it, it was just like night and day. Yeah. It's fabulous. And extracting every bit of performance out of that game bird was eye-opening. Absolutely eye-opening. I mean, I extracted a lot out of that airplane.
I've been watching the G meter go up in your Facebook posts, you know, so yeah. you're operating it the way it should be operated. So good on you.
That was a fabulous time.
And it's amazing how coaching can help. When I went to my first coaching session for aerobatics, I wasn't sure what I was going to get out of it. You know, here's a guy that's been flying airplanes and in the Air Force, and you know, I think I can do everything pretty good, even though it's a grassroots Citabria. And then to get those few pointers for each maneuver and now completely change my performance in those maneuvers and know that it's changed and know that it's different and feel that it's different. And for me, the slow roll was the big thing, because the Citabria just doesn't have a roll rate, so there's a lot of negative involved, and there's no inverted fuel system, so there's a lot of quietness when you're inverted. And to have somebody on the ground going, "Yeah, you're doing it right, you're doing it right, you're doing it right. Keep going, you're good." is really important. So the only other thing we have to talk about, and you were doing a real good job playing it off, is I got my Kansas City Chiefs hat on.
I forgot you're a Chiefs fan. Oh my God. We were that close. McGitney.
What a great Super Bowl.
Yeah,
it was probably one of the best.
It was a great game. It was probably, you know what? I mean, we can go back and say the Rams against the, was it the Steve McNair and the Titans, I think they were, or the Houston Oilers. Do you remember the Super Bowl with Kurt Warner's first Super Bowl win, where it was Steve McNair was driving it down, and at the very last second, he caught it. Rams defensive back hit the wideout right on the 1-inch line. Timeout, game over. Rams win. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah.
And then of course the one where the Seattle Seahawks were looking for a back to back, and everybody thought it was going to go to Marshawn Lynch. Yeah, that one. And this is arguably probably right there where it was overtime and. Oh, well, my wife and I were just going crazy. But in the end, it is what it is.
A young man named Brock Purdy off the bench out of nowhere.
Yeah,
and leads an NFL football team to the Super Bowl.
Right. Everybody was worried about him being nervous. And I told my wife, I said, I'm not worried about him. I'm worried about the other guys on the team.
Yeah.
Case in point, you know, Trent back-to-back holds. Case in point, the Tyron Williams 2.0 version where a punt is fire. You know, you play football, fire. Yeah. You go away. You do not. And then, of course, it bounces off. Ray's trying to grab it. And oh my God, right? I think everybody else was nervous. But Brock, cold water, ice water veins, ice water flowing in those veins.
I think we're going to be seeing him for a while.
Yep.
So, he's good. Good for him.
Yep.
Well, for everyone that's listening, our guest today is Dr. Joe McMurray, and he is a now no longer new, but very faithful and practicing GB1, Gamebird 1, Game Composites aircraft pilot. He is accelerating towards participating in the IAC at the intermediate level.
Yep, that's right. Intermediate
and then
this year.
And then are you gonna try and go unlimited?
No. I have no desire, no plans, no aspirations to make the advanced team, world team, unlimited team. That chapter is gone. I'm an older guy now. So I love the intermediate. I love the challenges in which it has, the unknown. We can stay in intermediate for a little while. Advanced, a lot more pushing, as you know. And a lot more pushing, negative snaps too as well. So I don't know. I may dabble into the smooth awards for advance, but I really don't think so. Right, at least right now, I really enjoy the challenges in the intermediate. It's just a heck of a lot of fun, especially when you have a more than capable airplane in the GB1. It makes it so much more fun. Mm-hmm.
So today we're going to talk about how your matriculation through flight training, like your first lesson was in the GB1, and you've done nothing but fly the GB1 your entire career of aviation. And that's how you became so good at flying the GB1, right?
Well, I wouldn't say I would put an asterisk, not my entire aviation, but in regards to aerobatic flying, I cut my teeth with the Super Decathlon. Like most people listening to this podcast, Citabrio or Decathlon or Super Decathlon, I cut my teeth with the Super Decathlon. But the jump to to a higher performance airplane, In fact, since October, since I picked her up brand new with only 5 hours in it, she has 105 now in it. So in 4 months, put 100 hours plus.
You're working hard.
And so yeah, you can, and 0.5 at a time, as you know, acro is not 2 to 3 or 4. It's 0.5 at a time. Mm-hmm. But no. I think when we get started in aerobatic train and aerobatic flying, there's two types of pilots. There's the individual who is brand new to flying, brand new to aviation, and just fell in love with acro. And I can see that. That wasn't me. I had no aspirations of flying acro. I had a lot of aerobatic pilots in my airport, but 20 something odd years ago, no, if you were to tell me that 20 something, 24, 25 years later, I would be in a high performance, unlimited aerobatic airplane and doing snaps and tail slides and inverted spins, I'd say, you got to be crazy. That's not what I wanted to do when I went into flying. So I'm not new to flying. There's that other group where individuals like myself aren't new to aviation, but new to aerobatics. And that's what I'm trying to talk to those individuals that are not new to aviation, but new to aerobatics, as well as hopefully some of the things in which I've learned over the several years that hopefully will help those individuals that are new to aviation and new to aerobatics.
Yeah. So I think that's the kind of the message you're carrying to the community now. And that's, I think, what we're going to talk about. And same. I mean, yeah, I've been doing aerobatics for 20 years in the Air Force, but I'm new to competition aerobatics. It's a different way of thinking. Definitely a little bit more, dare I say, more disciplined than the military from the standpoint of it's not just go up and do what you need to do for learning purposes or for maneuvering purposes against an adversary. It's now you have to hit these certain gates to make the figure look correct, the way it looks on the paper to the judges. Yeah. So it's difficult. It's not easy.
Yeah. No, you were taught, well, as you know, there's two types. There's combat aerobatics, which what you did. You had an adversary. You either had to hunt or avoid being hunted. Yeah. Whereas in competition aerobatics, it's illusion. It's all about the illusions.
Yeah, that's right. So let's talk about your chronological matriculation. Oh. So where did you start? And you already kind of hit on a little bit, but where did you start? And then how did you end up in the game bird? So we got kind of the end game there up front, and that's okay. But where did you start?
Yeah, so like most individuals that are learning how to fly these days, I cut my teeth on a Cessna 172 back in 2000. Mm-hmm. And about 2001, where actually right about the time when 9/11 occurred, we couldn't fly for a little while, as you know. So we had to suspend my training around that time. And then there was just other things in life. I had a young family, had to kind of slowly kind of pick that one up. But it was right after 2000. It was early January of 2002 is when I got my private. And from there, with the 172, we transitioned over to and got my instrument rating, which is this constant, and this is the thing, it's just constant acquisition of ratings. Why? Why? Because I wanted to, one, keep aviation fresh. Number two, what was that license to learn in which the moniker ends up go out, but very, as you know, the data, very little people kind of do it. Well, I wanted to keep that freshness in it, that aviation, that constant thirst for knowledge. So right after that, it was instrument rating, started cutting my teeth into a 182. I knew I wanted something a little faster, so I bought a Bonanza, and this is the first of my transition trainings in which I had going from a 172, or, you know, renting a 182 and getting my high performance as well as your retrack. I got my retrack on the Aero and then hopping into a big bore IO 550 Bonanza. That was a huge leap. Everything happened extremely fast. I was a low time pilot. I think 250, 300 and something odd hours, right? And what was extremely helpful was that when I joined the Bonanza Society, there was an individual who basically wrote the Bonanza training at Flight Safety. And he instilled upon me that constant, always taking it as a profession, looking at it as a profession. Though, Pete, as you know, that's not my profession. My personality, my philosophy was that I'm going to treat this as a profession, though it's a hobby, and I'm fortunate that I can have a nice airplane. I'm going to treat this as a profession. So what did I do? I flew well over 30-something hours with him transitioning. Every year for almost 8 years, I would fly back to Kansas City, and to Wichita, and attend Flight Safety every year. And that kept things fresh, kept things alive. I went ahead following that to get my commercial. And then right after that, I went ahead and got my CFI. And this was around 2007, 2008. And Pete, that was probably the hardest one, was the CFI rating.
Yeah.
Once I received it, this was before the Colgan accident. And right after that, it was just a simple matter of, you know, I hate to say this, but, you know, paying $250 to the DPE and getting my ATP. So, but it was keeping that aspect of it fresh, keeping the aviation treating aviation more as a profession than a hobby. And those were the transitions. So how did I even kind of keep things fresh even after that? Seaplane ratings, which, as you know, is a true rating, but learning how to fly a T6, getting some time in a Dutchess, learning how to fly Pawnee and tow plane pilot. So I was a tow plane pilot for a little while too as well. But I think the journey mentioned is that for someone like me who it's just purely a sport, it's a hobby, it's a passion, keeping it fresh and treating it like a profession and not just, you know, a weekend jaunt to $100 hamburger. I think that's because I'm bringing my family back then, of course, bringing my family in the plane, myself, and then just that constant quest or thirst of more knowledge.
So you hit on something that I try and hit on with all of my clients, as well as applicants during the debrief, especially at the private pilot level, is flying is a profession. Just because you're not getting paid doesn't mean it's not a profession. I'm a professional. It's all I know is how to be a pilot. That's how I make my buck. But just because you don't make a dollar being a pilot doesn't mean you can't be professional. And I think, you know, that's one of those things that may have gone through some atrophy over the last few years with this very fast pace to get through all your ratings. And it's not that we're unprofessional. It's that it's not getting taught. It's not getting nurtured the way it was 20 years when I became a flight instructor. And every time you walked into an airport and you said, "Hey, I'm looking for a job. I'm a flight instructor. I'd like to, you know, make money as a flight instructor." The answer was no, 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 because you were too young. You weren't mature enough. Maybe you weren't professional enough, but man, professional is all you had at that point to try and get the door open. So if you were to define professionalism, and sorry not to put you on the CFI exam again with the FOIs, but what's your bottom line definition of professionalism outside of all those passion, sport, hobby words? What do you think defines professionalism from your standpoint through your matriculation in aviation?
Well, yeah, outside the ethics and morals that
right.
obviously mm-hmm. is CFI. So I'm just going to make a broad term, a statement with regards to how I feel a profession, what I do for a living, for example. What is a professional? Someone who treats their patients with respect. Someone who constantly thrives, who constantly wants the quest for more knowledge in order to treat their patients better. So with aviation, how do you do that? How does one become and treat aviation as a profession when it's clearly not their profession? Well, simple, continuing education. That's what all doctors have to do. There is a continuing education. So what's our continuing education in aviation? Well, you know, we got your flight review. It doesn't have to be only every 2 years. Who says that? It could be every 6 months. That's what I did. That's what I did. Every 6 months, called up my tight specific instructor and said, "You know what? Let's do an IPC. Let's do a flight review." "Oh, you don't need it, Joe." "Don't matter if I don't need it or not. Let's go and keep things fresh, right?" So treat it like that. Now I realize that there's money involved with it. It is what it is. You know, if you're going to choose a hobby that just bleeds your wallet, you're going to have to understand that you're going to have to kind of give and take, right? Yeah. So sure, you may not be in a position to go every 6 months, but dear God, you can take the wings course That's free. You can get basic phase wings 1, 2, 3. You can hop on AOPA where they have tons of videos. And that's exactly what I do. Wings member. I'm a big fan of being of Wings. I'm a big fan of the AOPA stuff. Whenever I have this sort of question or I have this mind fart, I'll go and I'll do the Wings course or I'll hop on AOPA. That's how. So continuing education, and continuing education could be through exactly what I told you, the Wings, the course at AOPA, calling up your instructor, going up and just basic maneuvers, things like that. That's how you treat that as a profession. No different than me as a doc, where I go back east, listen to a few lectures, or I'll attend a hands-on presentation at a hospital or at a local or someone's office, things like that. So that's how I was able to take what I knew in my world and apply it to aviation and treat that. And you're right, even though you don't get paid for it, treating it like a profession, one, it's good for you. You know, it's an investment in you. It's an investment in you. It's an investment in your, in your family as well. Because as you know, you're going to take your family up. It's an investment in your safety. And when you have that, and you have that confidence, not overconfidence, mind you, but when you have that confidence, flying then becomes fun. It becomes so much more fun, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you're hitting it, and you're also demonstrated, because you have, you've already talked about humility and passion, but you also demonstrate the enthusiasm, you know, of a professional. And in the Air Force, we always said it was throughout the entire Air Force pilot cadre, but it's usually when you elevate it to the instructor level, we talk about humble, approachable, incredible, right? Mm-hmm. You can control those three things all the time. Those don't cost anything to control. And like you said, maybe your budget doesn't allow you to do a flight review every 6 months. So be it. But that doesn't mean you're unprofessional if you're budgeting to do something more than, whether it's budgeting time or budgeting cost, to do something mm-hmm. more than the minimum. And then mm-hmm. I liked your discussion about every 6 months for a flight review-ish. I do kind of the same thing. I renew my flight instructor certificate every 12 months, not every 24 months, because there's always changes. I do an IPC every 6 months, whether I have my 66 hits or not, because mm-hmm. the pace of avionics upgrades is mm-hmm. every 6 months, there's new avionics. And mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. for somebody, a guy like me, who's flying different airplanes every day, somebody shows up and they go, hey, I just got the brand new whiz bang, whatever it mm-hmm. is off the shelf, 2024 model. If I don't uh-huh. know how to operate it, I can't really evaluate or test that well, you know, and provide an exam for that person that well, if I haven't gotten a little familiarity with it. So I'm out there doing the same thing, and mm-hmm. kind of along the lines of what you're doing. And so you went from Cessna 172, yeah. you went through the Aero, you went to the Bonanza. So now you're in the Bonanza and you're zipping around the airspace, you know, 200 knots, not even breathing heavy anymore. So, so you got your seaplanes, you got all the follow-on stuff. And I think that's a big thing. If you're going to be a professional, you're talking now, we're going from it's professional, but it's also a lifestyle too.
Yeah.
Because it's a constant pursuit. Now we got the Aero, we got the seaplanes, we got the Bonanza. How long did you have the Bonanza before you decided you might need something different?
Oh, Pete, I had that Bonanza for 22 years. That was... Wow. She was a member of the family. She was a member of the family. And the Bonanza has served its purpose for decades, bringing the family back and forth down to Southern Cal, flying to Mexico or Canada and Midwest a lot. But as my children got older and as they moved on and with their careers, their life, and their kids, it became less and less of a plane in which I mission-oriented, where it was just me, you know, just me and six passengers, IO 550. And I would try to fly it more, but it became just mission oriented. Like, I got to have a mission. As you know, each plane has a mission. And the Bonanza's mission was long distance. I had air conditioning, leather seats, soundproof pane windows, double pane, by the way. You didn't have to wear people in the back. They didn't have to wear headsets. Tinted. It was comfortable, but I didn't go anywhere. And there were often many, many times for 6 months, other than heading down to Southern California, that we wouldn't go anywhere. And just and I started getting into seaplanes, and I enjoyed that aspect of it, the backcountry, the quietness, the solitude. I loved it so much, I ended up buying a seaplane. Mm-hmm. And I started flying more and more. I think in 1 year, that's what I do. I just fall in love with it. And 1 year, I think I flew well over 300 hours in seaplane. So, and the bonanza was started to fall back down more because it was just me in the seaplane. And my instructor, at this, my instructor said, hey, if you want to be a really good seaplane pilot, go get your tailwind endorsement. I said, all right, well, I'll do that too. So I think about 5 years ago or so, I went and got my tailwind endorsement, but I did it in a fun way. I went up to Hood River and went with the guys over in TAC Aero and flew with a really wonderful and great instructor who challenged me. And to this day, we're still very, very good friends. And I flew Super Cubs back there. And so I got my endorsement. And from that point on, he did some things in which he says, hey, you know what, Joe, you should take a UPRT class. And I'm like, you know what? I've been thinking about this whole UPRT thing, right? He says, yeah, it doesn't have to be acro, but at least take something like that, you know, because, you know, flying in the backcountry, low and slow, stuff like that. I said, all right. So called up my buddy at Bend, Mike Clock, cuckoo. Mm-hmm. And he has a great, and I'm going to plug Mike at Specialized Aero, has a wonderful UPRT, I think it was five, I think I took the 5-day course. I don't recall right now, mm-hmm. but he introed me, just gave me a slight taste of aerobatics. And Pete, I tell you, my first time up with him, other than the CFI, you know, going for the spin indoors and blah, 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 right? I think my first 10 or 15 minutes, I got dizzy, didn't know where to look, but I loved it. It was fantastic. And with a wonderful instructor as Mike, who was fun to fly with, who was a fabulous instructor who challenged me. From that point on, I said, I need some more of this. So mm-hmm. I called up Patty Wagstaff mm-hmm. and I Pete, get this. So I told my wife, I said, hey, honey, let's go to St. Augustine. Let's get a little Airbnb and take a little vacation there for about a week. Sure, hon. Yeah, I've never been to St. Augustine. I said, this will be great. It's a little, kind of little cute little town in Florida. It's not like Miami or Cocoa Beach where we've been to many times. And I said, it's really neat. She goes, okay. I said, by the way, dear, I'm going to be gone for like an hour in the morning and an hour in the afternoon. I'm going to be flying aerobatics. She goes, wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
And with Patty, and particularly with Alan Moore, I just, aerobatics was, and it suits that part of my personality, which is a constant challenge to be perfect. As you know, it can't, but along the way, I hope to get pretty good, like the saying, like Vince Lombardi said, right? But now I have something in which will challenge me every single day, something that will, that when I go up, is now I have this mission. How can I get a vertical line? How can I get my 45 line? How can I stay in this box? And so this mission now became, I hate to use this word, but more of an obsession now, where I said, okay, I got an airplane that can allow me to do this. Yeah. So I ended up buying a Super Decathlon. Yeah. Real fortunate that at that time, the Super Ds at ACA were affordable. And now they're like anything else. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe a new Super D costs this much. And it was, the timing was great. Right. So now I'm in this fortunate position where now I have three airplanes in the library. And my wife looked at it and she says, you've got to be kidding now. Right. I said, that one has a mission. That one has a mission. That one has a mission. And my wife just shook her head, turned around with the hanger. But I said, you know what? I'm just going to have fun with the Super Decathlon. I had no idea that competition even existed at that time. I really didn't. It was just more of, I'm going to go and learn. So other than Patty, who did I learn from? Wayne Handley. So the great Hall of Fame, Wayne Handley, who doesn't live very far from me. So I went up and I flew with him, and I got more and more aerobatic experience with Wayne. And he said to me, hey, Joe, you should join the IAC. And I'm like, well, what is that? And hey, you know, think about competing. And I said, no, I tell you what, I don't think I'm going to do that. That's just not for me. But gosh, that competitive blood in me. So I called up, joined the ISE, joined the club, and went to the first practice session. And I think from that point on, I was really hooked. And so again, with that personality, like I told you, which is that I want to learn more, the constant challenge, how do I go about becoming the best pilot that I can be and be a safe pilot along the way? Well, you know, I have to fly. I have to fly. You know, I have to learn from those that are knowledgeable. I have to do my due diligence, but I have to fly. You know, I have to treat it like a profession.
Like yeah. So you brought up SAW, Specialized Aero Works, and KUKA. In building out my business, I won't go into the long trail of sorrow on that, but building out my business, I look at SAW, and that's what I know. That's what I call it, SAW. I look at them, and I'm like, that's what I'm modeling. And now, you started to find out this as you get into this aerobatic world, the aviation world starts to get small, really small. And we all start interacting with each other. We didn't know each other yesterday, but now you're in this aerobatic world. And now Mike and I are working a national level UPRT FAA wings Zoom. We're trying to get it for mid-March. And he and I are he's going to host it on the West Coast. And then we're going to do it again not really the East Coast, but I'm representing the East Coast in Memphis. Yeah. And we're going to have Rich Stoll as the guest. So, fabulous. I mean, you know, we're planning for a Zoom that's going to be like 800 or 900 people. It's just, it's crazy. Right. So what great work that they're doing, and they're kind of out there leading that. I don't want to say it's a small business, but we have all over the country. I told Rich, I was like, we have all these diasporas of upset recovery training, and nobody's connected yet. And now it's starting to connect, and it's getting pretty amazing. And then, you know, you talk about those icons of aviation history, or I won't even say history, but just icons of aviation. You have Patty Wagstaff, who's out there, and yes, you can go train with her. Mm-hmm. That's
crazy.
That's your thing, man. Like, you just have to go. You just have to save the money and go. You know,
You really do. Just have to. Just again, it just costs money, and I understand about some individuals can, yeah, but boy, man, if you don't understand that it's really going to cost some money, you just have to reside in the fact that it's going to. If not, learn pickleball. You know, pick up pickleball. Learn pickleball. It is what it is, right? If you're going to be a physician, if you're going to go and become a lawyer, whatever, it's gonna cost money, you know. Yep. But that's your profession. If you're going to be a professional pilot, if you're going to fly the big iron, you have that route to go military, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's going to cost a heck of a lot of money. But the return is that this is what you are. This is your life. This is what your profession is. If you want to be a darn good pilot, like what I'm trying to do, you're just going to have to save a little bit and just understand that you may not be able to go on that Hawaii vacation. You know, I mean, you got to prioritize, obviously, you know, kids, family, you have to prioritize all of this. Certainly have to have a spouse or an understanding partner too, that realizes that this is what makes you happy. But boy, oh boy, you know, I hear that a lot, and I fully understand that, but man, go play pickleball. I think that's something.
It's the financial commitment that makes it a lifestyle.
There you go. Well said.
Yeah, it's part of your lifestyle, right? Well, it's an investment in how you want to live your life.
Investment in your lifestyle. Well said. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I have that perspective because the military was my lifestyle for 20 years. So it really drove home the fact that when that phone rang, it was time to kiss the wife, hug the kid, and it was time to go do the job, right? The job. That was the lifestyle. And if I was going to fly, that was my cost. My cost was getting paid, but my cost was separation from family. So there's always a cost. The answer is always yes, but what's the cost, right? And then that's what we get to, and that becomes the lifestyle. So We have mission. And I think that's really important. And I'm not keying in on that because I'm a military guy. Mission's really purpose, right?
Purpose.
Going out to fly an airplane without a purpose is actually pretty dangerous. You're not paying attention. So I think that's a really important takeaway, that when you go fly an airplane, whether it's a 150 or whether it's a 777 international captain going across either the Pacific or the Atlantic, you got to find that purpose. You got to find that mission to keep your mental acuity engaged for that time period.
That's good. That's good, Pete. As I mentioned this in my club, there was a gentleman who had talked to me. He says, well, you know, there's really kind of nowhere to go, Joe. And, you know, I don't want to go back over to Half Moon Bay for the $100 hamburger. And I said, Dave, I said, when you fly, it's not just a mission to go and get a hamburger. I said, just doing three in the pattern teaches you so much, teaches you so much. So go up with this mission, with this attitude, like, you know what? I don't necessarily have to go get a hamburger today to go and make an excuse for flying. Today, I'm going to go up and I'm going to work on, if you're not a commercial pilot, you can work on ground reference maneuvers again. When was the last time you worked on ground reference maneuvers? Or if you're a commercial pilot, when was the last time you worked on, you know, chandelles? When was the last time you did a short field landing? You know, those are the things in which you can go up. Even when I had my Bonanza and I talk about just going up, I mean, there was a mission. I was going to either shoot an approach in visual conditions or do commercial maneuvers, three in the pattern. Try to really just don't. That's one thing Sean told me too. Don't just settle for it. Really, really, really try your hardest to be the best that day. Try your hardest. You know, don't settle for that center line being 3 feet over. Just bam, right in the middle.
Right. And we just got done with a conference out in Vegas, Flight School Association of North America. We have all these flight schools. And of course, there's a big discussion. It's an ongoing discussion. It's a huge elephant in the room. And depending on whether you're a DPE, a student, or a flight school, depends on what you call the problem. And most people call it as a DPE shortage. As a DPE, I call it a scheduling problem. It all depends on your paradigm to the issue. But one of the things that we were discussing was, okay, you know, the applicant is ready for their exam after their magical 40 hours of private pilot. Now they have to wait 4 weeks for their exam. And there's an argument that that is unfair. And it's like, well, hold on. Before we say that, once the applicant meets the airman certification standards, isn't that the standard that we're supposed to maintain no matter what now, whether we're taking another exam or not, or whether there was an exam? So I think we all kind of finally gravitated to the fact that when you're talking about a mission and when you're talking about purpose, it's as easy as going, I'm going to open up the airman certification standards and determine for myself today, do I still meet these? Because this is what determines if I'm an airman or not. And if I don't meet them, well, now it's time to make the phone call to the CFI and get the instruction to get back up to those standards, right? It's not somebody's opinion. It's black and white. It's one and a zero. You either meet them or you don't. And so I think there's a turning point coming. And then the other argument is everybody needs 1,500 hours. So if you got to get an extra 3 or 4 hours in an extra couple of weeks waiting for your exam, and I'm not trying to make that small by any sense, it is a issue. And there's becoming more and more significant every day that it lingers. But if you have to get 3 or 4 more hours in the delay to your exam, so be it. That's 4 more hours towards 1,500. It's now 1,496 that you need, right? So we're going down that road too. So you brought up training. You talked about 30 hours. We'll talk about insurance minimums, right? Because you've transitioned through all these different airplanes. And, you know, my tongue in cheek argument is, well, if the minimum wasn't the minimum, why is it the minimum?
With the minimum.
Right. So, so how do you
why
look
do you need
at
more?
Transition training versus insurance minimums?
Well, you know, we have to define minimum, right? What the smallest amount necessary, right? It's when you go to medical school, when you go to dental school, especially those two, would you like a doctor operating on your son with only the minimum skills necessary? I mean, you really have to stop and think, right? Yeah. No. You know, so why then do we accept those minimum standards? The ACS teaches us what's minimally necessary to pass the exam. I'm a CFI. I've given my student the minimum in order to go to Pete and minimally pass that exam safely, right? Safely. Insurance minimally asks 10 for the game bird, just 10. We just minimally want 10. Well, 10 hours, I can tell you right now, flying the game bird is, oh dear God, no, no, not even in the game bird, the bonanza, you know, at least for these high, personally speaking, for these high performance airplanes, a lot more than 10. So in my opinion, I think the way we look is training, and there's that word again, it's coming at learners. You know, remember when that word came out several years ago, you know, what's the definition of a learner versus a student? And I like to think of myself as a student. You know, a student is always learning, but a learner is not always a student. A learner learns only a skill, a task, minimum requirement necessary to pass, in this case, a test. And that's what a learner is. But a student of aviation, a student of medicine, a student of dentistry is always learning. Hence, a student is always a learner, but a learner is not a student. Right. So
and you think about mindset, right? The mindset of a student. The mindset of a student is I have learned enough to know that I don't know everything and I need to continue to learn.
Bingo.
Right. A learner may be somebody in the process of that, right? And then you you know, we talked about, you know, and I see there was a couple of Bonanza guys, some folks, some new pilots who bought Bonanzas. They're trying to get their 25 hours. And you talk about 10-hour transition courses or maybe a 25-hour transition course. Mm-hmm. You know, 10 hours in a new airplane, that's probably enough to learn how to fly it. I mean, learn how to land it, right? Learn how to land it.
That's it.
Learn how to take off. Learn how to run the checks, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not enough to learn how to fly that airplane. And when I found out that Bonanza is kind of requiring, I think it's a 25-hour minimum now. You see them, the Bonanza Society, you see them at the table at the local airport, and they're doing en route charts. They're doing the weight and balance. They're doing the takeoff data, the landing data. And then you're like, oh, wow. Like, they're going through private pilot all over again in that airplane. So when we say minimum, when we say 10 hours, even if it's a tailwheel endorsement, right?
Yeah.
It's takeoff and landings. It's not much more than that.
No.
You know? And there's so much more to those big block engines than just takeoff and landing.
Oh, there's the emergency procedures, as you know, right? The characteristics of Bonanza has this little peculiar, little nasty little habit of breaking to the right on a stall. It's, most planes are not supposed to brake, but that one breaks and rolls over to the right. You got to know that. You need speed on that final. You just don't chop it like a Cessna. Or even like a Super Cub, just chop it and go, game bird. You just don't chop the power.
That's right.
You just don't chop it. I mean, you drive it all the way to the ground, right? The aspect of minimal and minimum and student and learner, I never really subscribed to that word, because I always felt that word meant that we were just giving that person, that man or woman, a particular skill set to pass an exam. And that was it. Whether or not they decided to become a true student of aviation and pursue instrument, pursue commercial, just be good. You know, flying well is hard. Flying well is hard. Flying safely is just darn right challenging. Just darn right challenging.
Right.
And that's what we have. And with these insurance minimums and with these minimum transitions, you know, I'd like to see, we can't force people, obviously, but if we give them that sort of mindset, and with this podcast and with information out there that says, hey, listen, if you're going to transition over, you know, you can get the requirements or you can get your insurance and move on, but just don't stop there. You know, I got my 10 hours. I don't need a safety pilot anymore. I'm lock and loaded. I'm gone. I mean, there are Air Safety Institute, the ASI, they have just tons of information on individuals, unfortunately, in situations where there wasn't enough transition training. You know, they just got the minimum and they took off, you know, the Pilatus in Florida, the Hawaii one. I mean, you can name so many situations, the the Sukhoi guy, gentlemen. There are just so much, unfortunately, situations, cases in which we needed that person to humble down and to get more and more training. Not all planes are, as we know, created equal.
That's right.
And I took that with the Gate Bird.
Yeah. And you've hit on it, and we've said the word a few times, you know, it's safety or safe or safely. And I even had a client this morning I was working with who kept saying, oh, I want to be the safest pilot possible. So it's the shameless self plug. And you knew that was coming because it's my podcast. So I got to do that. So,
absolutely.
I've been defining that, and it took a while to get to this point. Well, what does safety mean? Right. Well, to me, and what I'm teaching, it's knowledge, application, skill, because we believe so much. We teach and focus so heavily on the skill.
Mm-hmm.
We forget the knowledge and application that has to come before that good skill. Point. So you get those people who are like, hey, I can take off and land. That means I must know everything about the airplane. Then right. off they go. I hate to throw the word dangerously around, but they're operating ignorantly, which can be dangerous, right? Which can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. They're not dumb. They may be completely capable, but they just didn't mm-hmm. get that training. So we can start landing the airplane, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
In all your transition training, because we talked about the Super D and then back in, we kind of started with transitioning into the Game Bird.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think your, I don't know, 1, 2, 5 principal lessons that you've learned through the all that transition training that you can go, hey, if you're the 172 guy and you're thinking about stepping up your game to the next level of whatever the airplane is in your next level, hey, here are the 1, 3, or 5 things that mm-hmm. I would really want you to focus on before you even step in the airplane.
Read. I think the first thing is read about that airplane. If you're stepping up from a 172 to a Bonanza or Super D to a Extra or Gamebird, read, pick up the POH, AFM, just pick it up and read. Read about the performance charts, read about everything from just the simplest thing, from how to start it, even a hot start, to emergency procedures for that airplane, read it. Next thing is, the next tip would be to find a competent expert in that airplane, in that particular airplane. And I put an asterisk there because, for example, RVs, there are different RVs, right? You know?
Yeah.
And what are called experimentals, especially with experimentals, that builder knows everything about that particular airplane because he built it and he knows all the nuances and the ins and outs. Sure, he may not be a CFI, but he knows everything about that experimental more than you. And even though you may be familiar with that particular experimental, because RVs especially are different, but you may not be particularly knowledgeable about that plane because John Denver, that switch could be in another location. Right, than what you're normally used to, right? So go with a skilled and competent pilot or instructor. And then the third tip would be practice. Fly a lot. Not part-time. I mean, as much as you can. Now, you know, unfortunately, again, I live in California. We got, 365 days flying a year. But It could be going to your local FBO or your local flight training center and hopping in the sim for that. If they have sims, hop in a sim. But one is read. Two is, you know, get some training with and look around. Look around, ask around. You know, if there's not a CFI that's familiar with that particular aircraft, talk around. Maybe there's an individual who's very knowledgeable about this airplane. May not be a CFI, but he's very, very knowledgeable. And the scuttlebutt will tell you that. And then, of course, once you're there, then just fly a lot. Just keep practicing. There's I forget his name now. I think it's Craig something. You know, do you ever read that? It's that book called The Killing Zone.
Yeah. I believe, yes.
Yeah, yeah. He talks about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I've read really, that. Boy, when I first became a flight instructor, I'd read it, you know, and it changes your mind about how you look at everything.
Right, doesn't it? Yeah. It changes my mind. I didn't read the second one, but the first one, I'm like, oh, my God, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't mean to scare you. It's not meant to scare you, but it's just, wow. Okay. All right. Yeah. I think those are the three things. And I took that with the Gamebird. So I read as much as I could. I read the flight manual, and I flew with their CFI. Mm-hmm. But I took it a step further, knowing that my plane wasn't going to be that I didn't want it built until a particular time. Right. So I had, knowing that I didn't feel that I was going to have enough time to get ready for it, I put it out so that I could get enough time to be ready for it. So I found Sean, mm-hmm. and every month, about a couple hours or so, every month for 14 months, I flew with Sean. And by the time I went and picked up my Gamebird, I'm the only one that had time and type well into the 60s, because I flew like 20, 25 hours just alone with the CF, with the instructor at game. Mm-hmm. I took a week off, I think two or three times out of that whole year, and just spent a week just flying with the instructor. And when I got back, I flew with Sean every month. And by the time I went and picked it up, it was just sort of, oh yeah, when was the last time you flew the Gamebird? I said, oh, about 4 weeks ago. I said, oh, we went up, did a few in the pattern, and the CFI goes, okay,
yeah,
you're all checked off.
Yeah, you're good. You're good. you've been doing it right. And I think about in the Air Force, when we talk about practice, and yet you can't really replace the airplane, right? But man, there were times where in primary training, we would go to literally cardboard and plywood mock-ups of the cockpit. And it had black and white schematics of where the switches were. And you would sit there and run your checklists, and your hands would be moving and your eyes would be scanning, and you would practice procedures. And mm-hmm. you know, those were free. I'm going to step outside my lane a little bit, because I know I'm talking to a doctor, but the power of your mind and your imagination and visualization of those things. And you see aerobatic pilots doing it all the time before they go fly, mm-hmm. you know, they're going through their sequence. I think we overlook that. We got this chunk of gray matter between our ears that is an incredible tool. And just because you can't afford to fly doesn't mean you can't afford to sit in a chair and go, okay, I'm going to read this and I'm going to visualize how I would apply it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and now you're getting ahead. Mm-hmm. You're getting ahead. And if you do it enough, you'll get ahead a little by little each time. It's a lot of effort, but you'll make small gains. And then when you get the opportunity to go fly the airplane, people are like, oh man, you really know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. yeah, because I've been making these small gains between my ears mm-hmm. in between flights. I think that's something that we overlook in general aviation a lot.
You know, the mental preparation, much like when I go to my office and I have, there's a procedure where I put a screw around that, oh gosh, what, about six inches into an area in the zygoma. And on the other side is the eyeball, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there is a spatial awareness you have to have, because the patient is supine. You're coming in with a screw right through the middle of the palate. It's literally a blind. It's a blind screw until you actually see it coming out through the base of the zygomatic bone. And the night before, I can close my eyes and I can see everything. I can see everything. In surgery, the same thing too. Sometimes I'll just close my eyes and I will feel where all the anatomy is, because I've been there so many times. There's a procedure that maxillofacial surgeons do where we put a saw on the inside of the jaw. And there is a particular location where the anatomy, you just have to have the touch and the feeling. And oftentimes when I'm in the hospital, I can close my eyes and I can just feel it, and I can just visualize it in my head where everything is at, where the anatomy is at. In flying, it's no different. You mentally prepare as you go to the airport. You do the normal stuff, NOTAMs, weather, blah, blah, all that stuff. but you mentally prepare. And I mentally prepare, I mean, from the GB1, but even when I was flying the Bonanza or the other planes, you start to just get mentally prepared for it. This is what I'm going to do. I got my pre-flight. I'm going through my pre-flight. And oftentimes I hate to be rude, but you know, when I bring the game board out, everybody seems to, it's like everybody wants to come by and I'm in the middle of my pre-flight.
Yeah.
I'm not rude, but I talk and I personally take a few pictures and I leave. Now I have to do everything over again. I just can't pick up where I left off because now I have to get my head into the game and start again. All right. Get mentally prepared to fly this airplane. And I think that mental preparation starts really on your way to the airport, visualizing not only just the instruments, obviously that part of it, but just what are you going to do? What are you going to do before you even fire up? What are you going to do before you even taxiing on the runway 32? Are you prepared when that engine dies on you? What are you going to do? Those are the type of things. That mental preparation starts with it. I know it seems like a lot, and it just seems like, oh my gosh, flying should be fun. Flying is a hell of a lot of fun when you are prepared for it, both mentally, physically, and skillfully. Then it's just so much fun. So much fun.
Before we hit the pause button on the recording, anything that you want to cover that we didn't cover? Mm. Anything that you're kind of doing this, I want to call it a little bit of a road show where you're talking about transition training and you're out there talking to the masses. Yeah. Anything that we haven't covered that you wanted to cover?
Oh, no. I think in short, the tips were the big one. The going beyond just being a student versus just a learner, getting out there and practicing, and not just assuming that because I flew a single engine piston that tailwheel that I'm good to go with every single engine piston there is out there. And lastly, it's just the humility portion of it, the humility, passion, and enthusiasm themes. That's a big one, you know. Certainly the humility portion of it. Yeah.
Dr. Joe McMurray, thank you so much for trusting a random stranger from Facebook in coming on the podcast. I have been looking forward to this day for a while. I know we've had our interactions Facebook and through other folks, but thanks so much for coming on. It was truly an honor to have you on. I look forward to maybe running across you at some IAC aerobatic competition. I won't be competing against you, or at least not this year, but maybe in the future. And so thank you so much for that. And I hope to see the Kansas City Chiefs and the San Francisco 49ers in the Super Bowl again next year.
Version 3.
And it's going to happen. It's like fate. The universe is right for that right now. And we'll see. Maybe there'll be a different outcome. I hope not. But for your sake, I do hope there would be a different outcome.
Yeah. Hats off to Kansas City. I didn't think they were even going to, I mean, on the road every single playoff game. So, you know, hats off to them. You know,
I'm surprised though. Well, I don't see the gold stripe.
I know. I was thinking about that, but didn't like the way it looked.
Got it. Maybe a little.
The red
and black.
Too,
yeah. That's right. It's there.